Welcome to the Brothers in Crime podcast.
We are brothers.
We talk about true crime.
We don't take ourselves too seriously.
And you shouldn't either. Oxford High School is located in Oxford Township, Michigan. The township's only about 1.5 square miles, and the population's around 3,500, but it's a bit deceiving because it's part of the second most populated county in Michigan, Oakland County, which is home to over 1.2 million people and part of the Detroit metro area, which is home to about almost 4.5 million people. With all that in mind, though, let's get back to Oxford High. Oxford is the home of the Wildcats, and they began occupying the building that they're in now back in 2004. Last year, the school enrolled about 1,700 students and had a graduating class of about 450. Until recently, the most controversial thing that I could find about Oxford High was a beef they had with Boise State about their football field.
Wait, isn't Boise State a college, not a high school? And isn't that in Idaho, if I can speak today? And if I'm not mistaken, that's a few states away from Michigan.
Yeah, you're right.
And they had a problem with Oxford High School's football field in Michigan.
Now, it wasn't the field itself, but it was what they were calling it.
Did they call it Boise State Field? I mean, this sounds like it's going to be stupid.
Well, it might be, but let me explain.
Well, I doubt there's a good explanation, but give it your best shot.
I will. In 2011, Oxford High spent almost $500,000 to install artificial turf for the football stadium. Initially, the turf was going to be paid for using public bonds. However, this got rejected by the voters, but the local football faithfuls in Oxford were not about to be deterred. Apparently, several athletics boosters put their personal homes up as collateral so the turf could be purchased. Now, you have a football player in the house. Would you put your house up as collateral so the school could buy a new field?
Abso-friggin-lutely not. $500,000 for turf on a field? Are you kidding me?
Well, when the fundraising efforts came up short, the boosters were left holding on to a $300,000 tab and in danger of defaulting on the debt and presumably losing their houses. Unfortunately, they were able to reach an agreement with AstroTurf that allowed for an extended payback period. But that isn't even the craziest part of this story.
Okay, so I'm still waiting for you to tell me what this has to do with Boise State.
Well, I left out one small detail about the new field. The turf is blue.
Oh, well, blue turf, that's why it's $500,000, because it's blue. Have these people not heard of grass?
So some headlines were made when Boise State University notified Oxford High that they held a trademark on the term, quote, blue turf, end quote, for their field at Albertson Stadium. Oxford was informed that it could not continue calling the field blue turf, but could use the terms navy turf, or Oxford blue turf, or true blue turf. You got any thoughts about that?
All right. This whole thing is stupid. For once, a group of voters actually did the right thing and said, hell no, we're not paying for this insanity. Supposedly, we don't have money for education, but $500,000 turf is what we need. And then you get the freaking lawyers in it and Navy turf, Oxford. Okay, whatever. So call it Oxford blue. Who cares? It's the football field.
Well, I like the way that this guy, Jeff Watrick for MLive, it's a news source up in Michigan, he put it. He said, quote, the garish color may not be the tackiest thing about Boise State's blue football field anymore. That's because the BCS caliber college football program is upset that Oxford High School in Oakland County wants to install its own blue turf. And they dared to refer to the playing surface as...
Yeah, I mean, blue is blue, and turf, it just makes absolutely no sense. Just use green. Football fields are green anyway.
Right, that's one way to avoid all of this. Well, I know that that's a lot of background about a high school and where it is, but the reality is this case we're talking about today is heavy. It's tragic, and it's heartbreaking, and it's fresh. It wasn't that long ago that the people there lived through this tragedy. And we want to acknowledge and respect that. And frankly, it just felt wrong to dive right into the horrific aspects of this case without giving a little bit of background about the town and a story that I thought was interesting and shed some light on, you know, the kind of people that live there. There are some aspects of this case that we want to discuss, but we want to do it respectfully and carefully. So a couple things. This case involves a person who committed an extreme act of violence and terrorism. I have no intention of using that person's name during this episode. And really, our focus here is not on that person who committed the heinous acts that we're going to briefly talk about at the beginning of this episode. And I need to give a brief overview to set the context for our discussion, but This is not going to be a deep dive on those actions of that person on the day that they occurred, which were horrible. So why do we even want to talk about this case? We want to talk about it because it's the first time, at least that we're aware of, where parents of a minor who committed a mass shooting have been held criminally liable for manslaughter. And we're not looking to shout opinions at you or convince you whether it's good or bad from a policy standpoint. Frankly, I don't know that I even care to share my opinion at all.
Well, damn it, that's the only reason I'm here. What the hell else am I supposed to do then?
You're the funny one. Be funny.
Oh.
We want to give you facts about the case and to discuss some of what makes this particular prosecution of these parents novel and the nuance. But ultimately, you need to decide what you believe about the policy implications and whether the law should be what it is or changed or whatever. Looking at media coverage of this case, there's been some attention-grabbing headlines. And given that it's in this category of being the first of its kind, that's understandable. But I think in some ways, this may be like the case where the old lady spilled hot coffee on herself and then sued McDonald's, and people went wild because they thought that that was a ridiculous lawsuit.
Okay, but wasn't it, though? I mean, coffee's hot. You spill it on yourself. It's gonna hurt. Is that really something McDonald's should be getting sued for?
Yeah, I mean, that's how a lot of people felt and feel, and I get it. And frankly, before I knew more about the case, I kind of felt that way, too. It was like, come on, really? Like, yeah, what do you expect? But when you really jump into the facts of that case, you suddenly find out that it just wasn't that simple. The facts, I think, make you stop and think, well, maybe her lawsuit wasn't as frivolous as I used to think it was. I don't want to completely unpack it here, but if you're interested, you can check out Liebeck v. McDonald's. That's the name of that case. The short version is that that nice old lady suffered third-degree burns, went into shock, and was in the hospital for several days and required skin grafts. Her attorneys found out that McDonald's was requiring franchisees to keep its coffee significantly hotter, I'm talking like over 20 degrees hotter, than what was essentially the industry standard. Her attorneys even went all over town and tested coffee at all of these different places, restaurants, and fast food joints, and nobody was keeping their coffee anywhere near as hot as that McDonald's. To make matters even more interesting, McDonald's had received several hundred reports of burns from coffee in the prior decade, and had even spent about $500,000 on settlements from coffee burn claims. The plaintiff in this case was willing to settle for her actual and expected expenses, which was about $20,000, but McDonald's only ever offered her $800.
Well, I mean, that certainly elaborates a little bit, and I don't know. It still sounds nuts to me, but hey, the jury did what they did.
That's fair, and at the end of the day, if you come out on it and you're fully informed and you still think that's crazy, that's great. And that's kind of the point of this case is, you know, if people feel a certain kind of way, I don't care who am I to tell you how to think or what you think the law should say, but at least understand the facts of the case before you reach that conclusion. So I bring up the McDonald's case because I think right now there are a lot of people looking at this case we're about to discuss and they don't really know the full extent of the facts. And they sort of just think, well, gee, this seems like a real stretch and seems like I might get in trouble for something that I can't possibly help or control. You know, you mean I might go to prison because my kid does something bad? And I think a full appreciation of the facts of this case, the circumstances that surrounded the prosecutions, it just helps to understand why the state decided to pursue charges and at least provides a frame of reference to reach an informed opinion about whether the state should be able to prosecute people under these circumstances.
I know that was certainly my first thought because having four or five kids of my own and a bunch of teenagers I'm responsible for, and the media, that was certainly the spin when this first came out. It was all about the parents being responsible for what the kid did. That was a little bit concerning, but after watching the case, I get it. Yes, it's scary, but I don't know, maybe it should be. And like Will said, we'll give you the facts, let you decide. Before we get into it though, trigger warning, there's kids involved here. Active shooter, mass casualty, blood and death, it's bad. So if that's too much for you, we understand. We'll see you in the next episode.
Yeah, and we don't plan to go into the details, but still, we're going to be touching on talking about it. Thanks for that, Bob. On November 26, 2021, a man named James Crumbly bought a 9mm Sig Sauer from Acme Shooting Goods in Oxford. James is 47 years old now. His son, who shall remain nameless, was 15 at the time James bought the gun. In case you've never purchased a gun, there's generally a process. In a situation like this, where it's purchased from a gun dealer or gun store, you fill out a form, you provide an ID, and they call that in to make sure you're legally allowed to purchase a firearm. And one of the questions on that form, which is a ATF 4473, at question 21A, says, are you the actual transferee buyer of the firearm listed on this form and any continuation sheets?
This is fascinating to me because when a person hypothetically goes in the alley behind the adult bookstore and sees T-Bone, there's no form to fill out. I mean, you just kind of, you see what's on sale that day and make a purchase. But anyway, so.
Don't incriminate yourself.
I said hypothetically, a person. T-Bone ain't got no forms. I don't know what to tell you. But basically what you tell me is on this form, it's asking you, are you buying this gun for yourself?
That is correct. And so James didn't buy it from T-Bone. He was at the Acme gun store. So he buys a gun. And at the same time, his son posts a photo on his Instagram holding this handgun and saying, quote, just got my new beauty today, Sig Sauer 9mm. Any questions, I will answer, end quote. And he also included one of the heart eyes emoji. So the next day then, the son goes to the range with his mom, Jennifer Crumbly. She's 45 now. And on that day, November 27, 2021, she posts on her social media, Mom and Son Day testing out his new Christmas present.
Okay, so the problem with this is that he's 15, so he can't legally own or possess a handgun, which this is a handgun.
Right, exactly. That is a big problem we have already in this story. Now, a couple days later, a teacher at Oxford High sees the son searching for ammunition on his phone during class and reports it. So he's like on his phone on Google or whatever, looking up ammunition. She reports it to the administration. The school contacts his mom and they let her know. Mom, Jennifer, ends up texting her son saying, LOL, I'm not mad at you. You have to learn not to get caught. That's a quote. That night, the boy recorded a video stating his plan to murder his classmates.
All right, can we back up just 1 second there?
Yeah.
Because from what I understand from watching the trial, it seems like even though this is in the Detroit metro area, it's in a little bit more of the country. And as they described, I think the defense attorney, that nutcase, repeatedly described, there's a gun culture there, hunting and outdoor activities, and I don't know, maybe even competitive shooting or something. I don't know. It just seems like it's pretty big gun culture there. So as I understood it, it wasn't so much that the kid was looking at ammunition. The problem was that he was screwing around on his phone when he should have been working. It wasn't like that was a big, oh my gosh, he's looking at ammo to kill somebody.
It's like if somebody would do that in New York City, where like nobody has a gun.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And I don't know, I wasn't there, but that was just kind of my takeaway. Now, recording a video stating his plan to kill his classmates, well, if that ain't a clue, I don't know what is Dick Tracy.
Yeah.
But as far as just that he's looking at ammo, in rural areas, that's not a big deal.
Yeah, for sure. And that's a good point. But I wonder, too, how much of that has to do with taking into account some of the other stuff that we're going to talk about in terms of his behavior and maybe some concerns they had. But it's a good point that really they were like, hey, he's on his phone. Oh, and he happens to be looking at ammunition or whatever. This is just pay attention and do your schoolwork.
Right. And as a parent, sometimes the school will notify you of something your child has gotten in trouble for that you don't necessarily see as a problem because you're a reasonable person and that's okay.
Yeah, right.
I don't think Jennifer Crumbly is the only parent that ever told her kid when it comes to something they did in school, I'm not mad at you, just you can't do this, don't get caught.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that's fair at this point, what we have, what we know, what she probably knew.
For example, a kid skips a class, and the school, obviously, they have rules, you're supposed to be in class, that's a problem. Does that mean that every parent who finds out their kid skipped class is going to ground them for a month? I doubt it.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair, right. Given kind of a little bit of benefit of the doubt, which I think I understand. So, we get to the next day. We're November 30th, 2021. This boy draws some disturbing, violent images and writes some disturbing words on a math paper while he's in school. And the school found this really disturbing enough, as I think they should have, to contact his parents and call them into the school to meet with the staff and discuss it. Despite the parents coming into the school, The boy was not removed from school. He wasn't taken home. His book bag was never searched, and he went on about his day.
And the problem here is, as much as I said, the issue of him looking up ammo, it wouldn't have been a red flag to me. The stuff that he drew and wrote on that paper was, although it didn't say it out loud, like, if that's not a school shooter, I don't freaking know what is.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw that, which, I mean, you do a quick Google search, it's not hard to find.
There's a gun, there's a person bleeding.
Underneath the picture of the gun, he wrote, "The thoughts won't stop, help me." And then on another part of the paper, there's a picture of a bullet, and above the bullet, he wrote, "Blood everywhere."
Yeah, that's disturbing.
To me, that's like, I don't know how you don't just immediately, there's an intervention that needs to happen. And that's the part, I think, in all this that I don't understand how between the school administration, the parents, all the adults involved who had that information didn't say, okay, like, this is so serious, like, you need to be removed and we need to address these issues right now.
We need to figure out what is going on in your head.
Yeah, and maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's a cry for help or whatever, but clearly in this case, it wasn't. And that's the thing. You have to, you know, you get something like that, I mean, you got to take it seriously. Later that same day, this boy would murder 4 students. He shot and wounded 7 other people, including 1 teacher.
The 4 students who died were Madison Baldwin, Tate Meyer, Hannah St. Juliana, and Justin Schilling.
Now, this whole incident only lasted a few minutes. The shooter was taken into custody without resisting or putting up a fight. He was subsequently charged as an adult with first-degree murder and terrorism, which he ultimately pled guilty to, and he was sentenced to life in prison on December 9th, 2023. He was 17 years old when he was sentenced.
All right, well, with that bag of shit out of the way, let's talk about these parents, when they were charged, what they did, and all that jazz.
Yeah, so that everything we've talked up to this point really was kind of the setup, just so that there's a framework of understanding of what happened in this case that led to or led up to the parents being sort of looked at, investigated, and as I'm about to share with you, on December 3rd, 2021, James and Jennifer Crumbly, the shooter's parents, were charged with 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter. And on that day, authorities were looking for them and they couldn't find them. And so a search was launched. Bob, I remember that you were really, when this was all going down, you were kind of following it. You want to talk about some of the details on this in terms of, they had a court date, at least my understanding, they kind of had a court date that was set. And I think there was some sort of maybe a gentleman's agreement, like, hey, they're wanted and they're going to turn themselves in or they're going to show up for their arraignment. And I think maybe that was supposed to happen and then it didn't. And there was some discussion on the back end about, oh, exactly why they didn't show up.
They had fled their home in fear because obviously, as the parents of the person who had done this, there were some people that were not happy with them. So they say the reason they fled was for their safety. They were in contact with their attorneys through text message on burner phones. It's a little weird because when they left their home, they did go withdraw a bunch of money out of various bank accounts.
You mean you don't have burner phones and $5,000 cash with your passports just in case you ever need to flee?
I don't have any of that, nor do I have bank accounts to draw it out of. So, you know, but I go see T-Bone. He hooked me up. Anywho, that's why they said they fled. They were in contact with their attorneys. As I understood, the attorneys were expecting to be able to surrender their clients without any dog and pony show. You can see from the sheriff's and marshal's perspective, these people are moving away from where they need to be.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking out money. So, no, we're not going to just sit around and trust that you're going to show up when we want you to. So they end up in, and the semantics of this are funny because that nut job attorney and the judge disputed this during the sentencing hearing, that it said that they were in an industrial building and the attorney was like, well, it's not industrial. And the judge was like, well, there weren't any retail businesses in there. So it's been called an abandoned warehouse, whatever. There was this building in an industrial area that the Crumblies had sort of hunkered down in. Somebody else that worked somewhere in this large building was out smoking and saw James Crumbly out there, called it in. And in the later at night, I don't know, I think it was around midnight, the police show up to get them. They spend an hour searching this building and the Crumblies are allegedly asleep during this search of this building, and they don't realize that anybody's there searching. until the police actually find them and tell them, come on, let's go.
Makes sense. And I did play a quote from, I think it was the Detroit police chief. He said, talking about them being discovered and detained, he said, they appeared to be hiding in the building, very distressed after they were detained. And he went on to say that he didn't know what their intentions were, but that, quote, this isn't indicative of turning themselves in, hiding in a warehouse. I just thought that was funny.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's the nice way of saying that they weren't heading to turn themselves in. They were on the run. And there were text messages brought in during Jennifer Crumley's trial between her and her attorney. The attorney actually volunteered them and produced them. And there was some discussion about what they meant because Jennifer had supposedly texted her attorney and said, you know, I think they've got us, or I think they've found us, or something to that effect. And whoever responded, I don't know, something like, oh shit, or oh wow, or oh my gosh, or something like that.
They didn't say the jig is up.
Basically, you know, what context is that taken in? Well, that was a debate that the jury heard.
Yeah. So you fast forward to the next day, December 4th, 2021, and a judge set their bond at $500,000 each, and they pleaded not guilty to all the charges. After December 2021, their son would plead guilty and be sentenced, and civil suits were filed against the school district. You fast forward a few years, as Bob likes to say, thanks to lawyers, and we get to January 2024 for Jennifer Crumley's trial for involuntary manslaughter. Now, her jury was made up of 6 men and 6 women. The trial lasted 9 days. The jury deliberated for 11 hours over the course of 2 days. So they certainly had some things to discuss. And I think we just want to kind of hit the high points about some of the interesting things that spilled out during her trial, some of the information, some of the testimony, the evidence. And then after we kind of unpack her trial, we'll talk about James's trial. And then we can get into maybe some of the interesting nuance and novelty of their prosecution. So with that, Bob, you want to start us out with some of the things you thought were interesting about the trial? Or
James's trial was almost a copy of Jennifer's with a few revisions. But during Jennifer's trial, one thing that stood out to me is that they charged her with 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter. So they did not charge her with any of the injuries that had occurred, or child neglect, or the terrorism, or I'm sure there's got to be something they could have charged her with, you know, aiding terrorism or something like that. But the state went straight for, these 4 children are dead, and you are partially responsible for that. My guess is that was strategic to keep it clean and focused and not be any confusion about it. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And I think it just keeps it, like you said, it keeps it clean. So you can present a clear story, a clear narrative. And I think it kind of streamlines presentation of the evidence and the theory behind the case. You know, like I said, sort of earlier on, this is a novel thing, right? This was, as far as I could tell, and several articles and news outlets have reported it this way, and to my knowledge, the first time that there's been this level of liability for parents criminally out of a school shooting. Well, I think the state wanting to push that boundary to the next level, it was I'm sure a calculated and frankly, I think a smart strategic move to not try to pile it on, or to not try to water things down, or, you know, to have to put in all this extra evidence about these other things, or, you know, you don't want the jury to feel like, well, you know, the state, man, they're just going after him after all these things, right? No, instead, there are 4 children who are dead, and we believe that these people are criminally responsible, and here's why. One thing I want you to talk about, and you've kind of started to give us a little preview with some quips and comments already throughout this episode, is you got some feelings about Jennifer's attorney?
Jennifer's attorney was a nut, a raving lunatic.
Can you say that you feel like that's your opinion before? Because I mean,
oh, yeah,
we're going to end up with a cease and desist letter. So.
This is all my opinion when it comes to anything I have said or will say about Shannon Smith.
You haven't seen her medical records or anything. Like, you're not saying she's actually crazy.
No. This is my thoughts, my opinion of her. And I don't think I'm alone, but this is just a layperson observing her in this trial. Makes me think that the elevator ain't going to the top floor. Or, like we said in the video we did, kind of breaking down her closing argument, she's either out of her mind or she's a freaking genius. Now, you said it would come down to what the jury said at the end, so we kind of know where that went. But no, again, this is my opinion. In my opinion, and I'm not saying clinically or anything, I'm just saying this woman is out there. God bless her husband.
Wasn't her husband? I remember this when we were doing the video breakdown. So her husband, and I think this is important, he like works with her for her, right?
Yeah, I think he is the office manager of her law office.
Right.
And her law office focuses on people that have been charged with sex offenses. For instance, she represented Larry Nassar.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, her position on that, you are a soulless attorney, so maybe you can see where this is coming from. But what you can find on her website and in interviews that she's done is that committing sex offenses is bad. Victimizing children is bad. But being accused of a sex offense that you have not committed is also very, very, very bad. And it can destroy your life. And I absolutely agree. That's kind of the conundrum of this. When you have a he said, she said type of situation, it's tough because you're like, if that guy did it, then, you know, he should burn in hell. But on the other hand, if he didn't do it, and for whatever reason, this story is not true, you don't want to destroy that person's life if they're actually innocent. So I could never imagine a world in which I would say, okay, I'm going to focus my time on defending the people that are charged with this crime.
I think that takes a very, first, everybody in this country, you know, has rights and is entitled to, solid defense and somebody who will vigilantly and dutifully protect those rights. No doubt about that. But to your point, that would be pretty challenging, I think. I think there would be a unique set of challenges and difficulties that would come with specializing in representing any subset of what society views as particularly heinous or just awful type of criminal behavior. So that is interesting. And Larry Nassar, he doesn't strike me as the type of, you know, he said, she said, or wrongly, whatever. I mean, didn't he get sentenced to like 7,000 years in prison? And my understanding of that case, which I don't know a ton, was that there was pretty much, it was pretty clear.
Right.
That he basically abused everybody that he ever had a chance to.
Right. There were dozens of people that all said he said it was dozens of he saids, you know, and she saids against one he said. So
yeah, that's pretty clear.
I don't know, but I think the connection, like, why would someone who tends to represent sex offenders come into this case? And my understanding was because her real focus is, while it tends to be sex offenders or alleged accused sex offenders, because like you said, innocent unless proven guilty. But I think her focus is really on defendants that are unlikable or unpopular. Because I think there is probably more of a bias when someone is charged with a sex offense to think more likely than not they're guilty before you've heard a thing. Likewise, coming into this case with the Crumleys, they were not going to be popular. Their kid had killed and hurt children in the community. Parents of school shooters are generally not the most popular people in town. So I think that's sort of her advocating for the underdog sort of thing. The whole thing makes me feel dirty, but you're right. Everybody needs it. So, you know, bless her heart. But the shenanigans that went on during the trial, she does everything on paper with sticky notes. I think she keeps Post-it in business. She had stacks and stacks and stacks of files. Part of it was to just sort of point at and say, look at all this crap the state gave me that I have to go through. But she ended up like knocking over one of these piles one day. And then at another point, I think it was in her closing, she made reference to all the TikToks that had been made about her and words she had used wrong or knocking over files or whatever. And you could tell it appeared she was personally offended by the things that people on social media were saying about her. And I don't know, she's probably a wonderful woman. Probably is. I mean, look, she's productive. She gets up every day, she goes to work, and she's doing something. So that's a plus. And she has sounds like a bunch of kids that are pretty good kids. I haven't heard about them in the news. So, you know, she's doing some good things, but wow, she was entertainment throughout the entire trial.
I want to touch on, so you said something about it seems like the unpopular clients or whatever. I don't know this, but she wouldn't be the first attorney to capitalize on the publicity, even if it's, you know, no publicity is bad publicity, right? So even if she has terribly unpopular clients, I mean, Larry Nassar, that case, that's a huge case nationally, internationally. This case, national news. I mean, we're sitting here talking about her right now on this podcast because she represented this woman. And so, I mean, that could be part of just the, you know, in order to get her name out there. I mean, that's free advertising.
Right. I mean, Mark Garagos has done very well with this. Most of his clients that we know about, all the famous ones, have been wildly unpopular.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So there could be some of that. Now, you know, kind of getting back into the trial, my understanding is early on, and we talked about this before we went live, but you mentioned how it kind of, essentially these trials started out with a lot of evidence about the shooting, the actual shooting, you know, that kind of stuff. And so in her trial, my understanding is at the beginning, there were people who were, you know, upset, understandably. And so there were some crying and some sobbing and whatever. And this drew some objections and some complaints. And there were things back and forth. I don't know if you want to talk about any of that at all, just in terms of...
There were a lot of what seemed to me to be like juvenile objections.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were objections about people showing emotion either in the gallery or the attorneys who were doing the questioning. Both of them had moments during questioning, both tables, where it's just very emotional. And when you're spending days talking about children in a school being shot and killed and bleeding to death,
mm-hmm.
it's bound to bring up some emotion. And the judge was careful in trying to instruct both sides and everyone in the gallery that, look, I understand this is horribly emotional, but at the same time, both sides are thinking about this, the prosecution and the defense. They don't want either side trying to capitalize on that and convince the jury that their side is the one with the heart and the other side isn't. This is just horrible to even think, but could they conjure up some fake tears and appear to be choking back some tears as a means to connect with the jury and how horrible this is and what the client was involved in? Or could the defendant and her side of the table do that, show essentially fake emotion to sort of connect with the jury and say, I'm a real human being and this is horrible and I see it. I'm not just a monster. That's a tough spot, I think, for a judge to be in and for everybody there. It's a strange world when we have to say, look, you can't be emotional about all these kids that were shot and killed.
Yeah, and I understand the reasoning behind it, but it's a hard
line. Well, the reason behind it is soulless attorneys that will use those tactics.
Right, right, exactly. So kind of turning to the openings, the state, when they opened, essentially said Jennifer didn't pull the trigger, but she was responsible. That simple, easy steps the defendant could have taken would have prevented the tragedy. And then the defense argued back that the shooter and what he did, this rampage that he had went on, that it wasn't predictable and that the state was wrong and that the defendant was not aware of the extent of her son's mental deterioration. So that was kind of how they framed the case at the opening statements. You got anything to add to that? I just try to keep it high level.
No, other than that was sort of the crux of the whole trial, is that she had an obligation as a parent to parent her child and intervene if things foreseeably could go off the rails, and she did not. They did bring in some salacious stuff. At first, Jennifer's attorney objected, but later she brought in all of the text communications that Jennifer was having with the fire captain she was stubbing in her spare time.
Okay, hang on. I got a note for that down here. I want to get to that in a second, and I want you to talk about that. But first, I want to talk about, I thought this was kind of an interesting point. So apparently, and I know from you telling me about this case and then looking at it some, that the defense attorney and the prosecution, they seem to kind of butt heads frequently. There were a lot of objections. And frankly, from what I watched, it seemed like there were several moments where the lawyers were a little more animated or a little extra, almost teenage-like than what you would hope for in a courtroom.
Yeah, that's what I meant by the juvenile.
Yeah.
The juvenile objections. It was really like, once two of your kids start fighting, you don't even know what it started about, but now they are just like siblings battling, and that was definitely going on here, both in the objections and in some other points. I mean, at one point, I remember the defense attorney telling the judge that the prosecution, which I believe was whoever the elected official is there,
mm-hmm.
that this was all a campaign speech, and she's doing this as campaigning, and blah, 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 and there were several times it was out of control.
Yeah, so apparently at one point there was a good bit of tension between the two parties. I think one of the prosecutors was moving some digital evidence or digital exhibits into evidence and was doing it rather quickly. The defense attorney was having some trouble keeping up or whatever. And then I think it was at the end of the day, the prosecutor asked the court to admonish the defense attorney for making a joke about killing herself. Do you remember this?
Yes.
And the defense attorney was obviously, you know, protested in a very hurt, the way that she would protest, what you would expect if you watch her in trial, and stating that her remark was not intended to offend anybody. And then this sort of turned into this just crazy argument about which side was being more insensitive to the victim's families. And like you said, it sounded to me that the way the judge basically dealt with this was just squashed it by saying, all right, that's it, we're done, everybody's going home.
Yeah, the same daggone way a parent with two fighting kids would
go to your room, go to your room, we're done.
That was in the end, because it was the argument was never ending, and the judge had already pointed out, okay, I understand, Ms. Smith, that it was a comment, you didn't mean what you meant by it, but saying kill me in front of a gallery that has family of dead children shooting victims, probably not a good thing to do. But I do remember the day you're talking about, because they kept arguing and finally the judge had to pretty much say, that's it, this is over, go home, and got up and kind of walked off the bench and like, we're not doing this anymore.
Yeah, I had enough. And it's my understanding that Court TV reported that the judge sent them all home, but it wasn't before the defense attorney had flown into tears and ended up with, like, her makeup was pretty smeared and she was pretty upset about this whole thing.
She was, because I don't think, you know,
she didn't mean it.
I don't think she's an ill-intended person. Yeah. And she was not afraid throughout this whole entire trial to highlight her ineptness and the fact that she was one person going through all these files that the big bad state had dropped on her, and she was raising kids and running an office and taking care of her client and had to do all this, and sort of pointing out all the things that she herself does wrong, little things like misstating a word or tripping or what have you. And I don't know if that's part of her personality or if that was part of her strategy, mm-hmm. is to show her human nature, but it seemed to be a little much to me personally.
Yeah, but she ended up coming back the next day and apologizing to the court about the comment, right? That's my understanding.
She did, and you know, that's good. You can't unring the bell, but
you
know,
you can say you're sorry.
It is good
for
to
it,
say, so, I, you yeah. know, and who in this world has not had words come out of their mouth that they did not intend in a certain way, and when they realized, holy crap, this wasn't right, and felt like an absolute piece of crap.
I mean, I'm not sure that I've had a single day of my life where I haven't done that, so that's yeah, fair.
I have more instances of that than I care to remember.
Now, switching gears, it's my understanding the Crumbleys had some horses. Is that true? These are horse people? They got some horses?
Yeah, and look, if you want to keep it high level, the point the state seemed to be making is that Jennifer was busy with her horses. She was busy with her boy friend. She worked. She was having this affair. She was caught up taking care of her horses. So she wasn't paying attention to what was going on in her kid's life and didn't really care. And that's what one thing led to another.
So the state is arguing that she cares more about the horses than being a good mom. Essentially, I'm paraphrasing. So it would be pretty interesting then, it sounds like, that one of the things that they admitted or some of the evidence they got in was the horse farmer who, I guess, boarded the horses testified that Jennifer had contacted her about selling this horse in the hours right after the shooting. Now, what do you make of that? I mean, you think that's just like prudent behavior, or you think that goes in with the whole let's get liquid and get our burner phones and get out of town?
I really couldn't tell you because I couldn't get a read on this woman. Now, one thing I do want to say, and I'm not defending her, but one thing you need to keep in perspective is by the time Jennifer Crumbley testified at the end of her trial, she had been close to 2 years in jail, and she was in whatever custody that keeps you in a cell by yourself for 23 hours a day. Mm. And that can make a person go cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs.
Yeah, for sure.
Like in a week. So it was very difficult to sort of gauge her demeanor and the things she was saying, knowing that she has been locked up 23 hours a day, and I'm sure having mental issues from that alone. But no, I don't know what the deal was with the selling the horse almost immediately after Jennifer and James heard that the shooting had happened, they knew. Now, Jennifer says the worst thing she thought that would happen was that her son would kill himself, but they very quickly figured out what was going on.
Mm, okay. Now, you've mentioned or alluded to Jennifer's firefighter daddy a couple times, and I think it's time we talk about that. My understanding is after the shooting happens, Jennifer basically kind of confides in and seeks some sort of comfort, or whatever you want to call it, from, we'll call him her lover, this guy Brian, who's a firefighter, and apparently they kind of knew each other from high school or something, and they were having an extramarital affair. And this originally, my understanding, so you can clean this up for me, but my understanding was there had been some pretrial motions filed by the defense, and the court had essentially granted them that the nature of their relationship or the extent of it was not going to be put in front of the jury. But there was an issue where the defense attorney suggested that there was some stuff with the firefighter that you know, maybe he was being threatened with the loss of his job and benefits if he helped Jennifer. And so then prosecutors argued that with the changing of strategies in the trial now, that they wanted the affair to go ahead and come in. And essentially, without getting into the weeds too much, the court kind of said, yep, you know what? Okay. And so now the jury got to find out not just that, oh, she's having some conversations with this guy, but the full extent of their relationship. Does that track? And then do you want to just tack on anything else about this firefighter?
I mean, that sounds pretty accurate, and nothing about him in particular stood out to me other than poor taste, because Jennifer wouldn't have been my first or 1,000,000th pick, but, you know, whatever. Everybody has their own thing.
You always like to shame people. You know that? You're kink shaming. You were getting on people who like clowns the other day, and now... You know,
I didn't put Jennifer in any specific class. I didn't say anything about her that wouldn't make her in my top 1,000,000 list. Just overall,
she
wouldn't
there.
Happen.
All right.
It wouldn't have. She wouldn't make it there.
In my experience, if somebody, and I'm sorry if your name's Jennifer, but if your name's Jen, I'm out. Like, I'm just, that's sorry. Bye.
Yeah, I can't say I've had bad luck with redheads, Jens. I do know one good Jen, though.
I mean, of course, it's not like a rule that applies to everybody, but, you know.
I don't know any redheads I'd mess with.
You put your hand on the stove once,
yeah,
and you don't do it again. That's I'll just leave it at that.
What you're saying sounds like it is the way it happened. I do remember at one point when something started coming in about Jennifer's affair, and Shannon Smith objected, said, no, you know, Judge, we decided we weren't going to talk about this, and even the judge was like, yeah, but then you said this could come in, and the attorney looked kind of surprised that she didn't think it was all coming in.
Yeah.
And just like, no, you know, you did it. Here it is. Some of the things I thought were pretty petty and stupid, like when the state is looking at these messages between Jennifer and her boy Toy, she was asking him about checking on Facebook pages and seeing if they're shut down. And the state was trying to use that to say, I don't know what Jennifer was supposedly doing, that she was trying to destroy evidence or something. And what came out very easily through the cross-examination of Boy Toy was that what she was trying to figure out was, has his page been taken down? Not delete evidence, but you have the ability to look. You're seeing what's going on. Is it gone? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's gone. So, like, I don't even know why we went down this road. That would have been such a simple thing for the state to figure out from the get-go. This Boy Toy was their witness. And I don't know why attorneys on both sides do this. They nitpick at things that don't matter, that have a completely obvious explanation. Like, no, if you could prove and it was true that she was trying to delete evidence, then fine, go for it. But when that's not really what happened, and it's pretty obvious to anybody who would take 5 minutes and think about it, or just ask the question, that's not what happened, why try and even put that out there? Like, why focus on stuff that isn't?
Yeah.
I don't understand you people.
Well, don't lump me in with the whole crowd, you know?
I'm more of a My Cousin Vinny kind of guy. You know, I think he has some of the best remarks, objections, and questioning in all of law that ever was. My favorite being...
Everything that guy just says is bullshit. Thank you.
Trials would be a lot more interesting if they were all that way, but I mean, I can't argue with you. But turning back to the case, a couple more pieces of evidence before we get to the big turning point, I think, in this case, or, you know, the last really important thing we have to talk about for her trial. So there were some excerpts from the shooter's journal that were found at the crime scene that kind of revealed his intent and plan to, quote, as he put it, shoot up the school. And then, you know, the state ultimately rested its case after calling this veteran of the sheriff's office who got on the stand and recalled details of one of the victims while weeping, which I'm sure, I'm not saying that anybody who's going to talk about that's going to be emotional. That's understandable. And I have no doubt the state wanted to put somebody on who was there and who could testify, who lived through that and could share some of what that was with the jury. But moving to the defense, maybe surprise, not surprise, Jennifer decided to take the stand to testify in her own defense. And this isn't always, but usually, generally, we would say it's a sign that things are probably not going so well for the defendant.
It's your only shot at that point. You know, if you're taking the stand as a defendant, it's pretty much that you've got to explain this story in a different way and make it convincing, because what the state has done so far is proven you guilty. That's the way I take it. I'm not a freaking lawyer. I'm just a normal person.
No, that's fair.
I mean, the main things were, as far as what Jennifer let happen that she shouldn't have, is, yes, there were these journal entries. Jennifer says she never saw the journal. How could I act on that? I never saw it. I didn't know this thing existed. There were text messages. Some text messages where the shooter had texted her and said, you know, I love you, or answer me, or something like that. And she did not respond to him. And so that was supposed to show that she, you know, didn't care and neglected him. There was a text message where the shooter had said to a friend that he really needed counseling and mental help, but he told his dad and his dad just laughed at him. There was another, I don't remember if it was a message or something, but there was some issue where the shooter had claimed that he was seeing things. I don't know.
Yeah, around the house.
Yeah, things were flying off shelves. I think he had texted that to his mother, that things were like flying around the house, this place is haunted, whatever. And it came across sounding like it was a mental health problem, which out of context it would. So I think the reason that they had to put Jennifer on the stand is because she had some explanations for some of these things. Mm-hmm. For instance, she explained that when it came to the text message about the house being haunted, that was just him joking around and being silly, that he and a friend of his played with a Ouija board and played pranks and it was all just silliness, and that I believe the testimony about the needing mental health help, and that had been like 6 months prior to the school shooting. I believe her version of that was that, no, not seriously, there was some joke around that or something. I don't know exactly, but each one of those things, she provided an explanation of, this is not just me ignoring my son. We did things. I had no interest in shooting guns, but I went to the gun range with him because that's what he was interested in. That was a sport, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, and it's cleaning things up. It's offering explanations for the evidence the state's put in. That's what they're doing. And just to clarify, right, like I don't know what the defense team was thinking or why ultimately Jennifer, at the advice and counsel of her lawyer, decided to testify. Only they know that. But I'll say this. I think people read into it a little too much about whether somebody makes what decision somebody makes, right? Oh, they didn't testify. They have to be guilty. That's the only reason they wouldn't, or whatever. At the end of the day, you have a right to remain silent. You don't have to testify. And frankly, like, why would you? It's not fun. It's awful. And you expose yourself to a lot. Like, I mean, you're already all out there. And not that I feel bad for anybody, but it's just the reality of it. So in a criminal trial where you have a right to remain silent, there better be a good reason to give that up. And in this case, like you just outlined, they needed to get her on there so that she could try to explain away some of the evidence and some of the testimony that was kind of damaging.
Because those points that the state was saying, this is where she should have parented and prevented this, there was no way on cross-examination that those answers could be elicited. I mean, sure, you can ask the detective who's reading from the journal, are you aware that Jennifer Crumley ever saw this? To your knowledge, did she ever see this? okay, and that person can say yes or no, whatever. You can ask when they're, whatever detective is reading in the text messages about this house is haunted, there's things flying across the walls. Yeah, you can ask the detective on cross-examination that's reading that, is it possible this could be joking? And put that thought out there, but it's not the same as the person that was involved in those messages saying, let me explain this. This is what happened.
We had an inside joke because, you know, whatever, and that's why he said that.
Right. I mean, you can drop the hints out there. And let me tell you something else, and you ought to know this by now. I'm sure you do. But, yeah, you have a right against self-incrimination. You don't have to take the stand in your own defense. And the judge, in every case I've ever seen, tells the jury, you are not to hold that against them. Now, do you think the jury listens to that instruction? You think they're capable of not considering that fact? I don't think any human being, there's no one that I would want judging me as a juror that wouldn't have a hard time having that enter in their mind that, look, I know I'm not supposed to take this into account, but I can't imagine how any human being would not consider that.
That's why I bring it up, though, because I think generally you're right. I think most people, I mean, that's the first thing you hear when somebody doesn't testify. Oh, he didn't testify. He must be guilty. Like, but the, part of the framework of our rights says you can't think that way, at least if you're going to sit in judgment of that person in a trial. Now, as the court of public opinion, think whatever you want. I don't care.
Right. Well, the idea is that the state should be able to, if this person is guilty, the state needs to come up here and prove it without anything from the defendant. It's not for us to prove we're not guilty. It's for them to prove we are. And so that's kind of the theory. And there's multiple reasons, as you already said, that someone may or may not testify. And that's a strategic decision. I think the strategy of this attorney, I think based on her persona in the courtroom, is we're putting it all out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're exposing everything. We're letting all our scars and blemishes and mistakes show. We have nothing to hide. Here it all is. I think that is her strategy as...
And I don't think it was a bad one.
...an attorney with her client. We talked about the text messages about where she didn't answer him, where he said he was seeing things, where he had said he wanted mental help and wasn't getting it, and she explained those. Then she also had to explain those things to me were kind of on the fence of are those an issue or not, but where it got really serious was the day of the shooting where she had been to the school, had gotten called to the school, saw this drawing on the math paper, which she claims that what she saw was not everything that's on that paper that's now in court, and that some things had been erased before she saw it, or I don't know. And that basically, well, the school counselor didn't think he needed to leave, so they're the professionals, that kind of thing, because seeing that drawing is an issue. And then there was a lot of questioning about how did he get this gun? And of course, as you brought up, they had mentioned that this gun was, while not legally his, it was known as his. And of course, as I imagine she would do, or her defense attorney, said that it was her husband's responsibility to secure that weapon. And to her knowledge, it was secured. It was in a case that was locked, and the key was kept in various areas around the house, in these steins or something, but basically sort of dumping that responsibility entirely on the husband.
Which I think is a great strategy. I mean, if I'm her attorney, then like, yeah, I'm going to go that route too. That makes sense.
Right, because I think that's sort of a physical, tangible thing that, okay, fine, you ignored all his mental health issues, but how'd he get the weapon that he used to do this? You should have made sure he didn't. Oh, that's not me. That's the old man, not my boy toy. I'm busy with him, but... You know, that was James's job to deal with. And there was a whole lot of discussion and questioning back and forth about when they're at the school and the fact that they only spent 12 minutes there. And the last thing that Jennifer had to say to the counselor was, are we done here? And there were some comments about her and James both saying they had to get back to work so they couldn't take the shooter home when...
And his job was...
He was a DoorDash driver.
Right, and she was a...
She worked for some type of a real estate, like, management company or something. But
she worked in an office,
Yeah, and they had her boss come in and testify that it wouldn't have been a problem. She could kind of come and go as she pleased. That was not an issue. Mm-hmm. In fact, when she left to go to the school, which she tried to get James to just go handle it, but she ended up having to go to the school too. But it was a matter of her saying to... her colleagues in the office, hey, I got to go to the school. I'll be back. So it wasn't a big deal.
Right. Now, we've covered a lot. I think there's one more thing that came out of her testimony that's worth mentioning, and then we can jump into the closing arguments and the verdict and all that. But I think whenever she was on the stand and she said that she wouldn't do anything differently given the chance, I think that was a moment that just, I don't know how you say that.
That was the end of her.
Yeah, I mean, really, I agree.
Like, I understand there's some legal strategy that has to happen here, because if she gets up there and says, I should have done this and I should have done that, well, you've just admitted that you're guilty of what we're charging you with. You yourself acknowledge you should have done all these things different. On the other hand, if she gets up there and says, when they ask that question, and she says, no, I wouldn't do anything different, it turns out to be what it was, which was horribly offensive to all the victims and victims' families in the room, and took everyone aback that having this knowledge, you wouldn't change anything. I feel like she was not well prepared for that question or didn't execute on it. If she had gotten up there and said, look, in that time, based on what I knew and what I was seeing, I did not know to do things differently. In hindsight, now that all these things that I did not know and was not privy to, hindsight's 20/20, I can see where these little things that I didn't think were a big deal combined with these other things that were unknown to me, absolutely, I would do so many things different than what I did.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's at the end of the day, like, who, you know, given the chance to stop that from happening, who wouldn't now, if you know all that, do something differently? But, and the question kind of sets her up for failure, but I'm with you. I don't know if it was a lack of preparation or if it was just she kind of fumbled the bag on the stand or what, but yeah, to say, well, I wouldn't do anything different. I'm sure the prosecutor sitting there making their notes for their closing argument going like bold, underline, underscore. Yeah, I'm going to bring this back up.
I mean, that could have been the entire closing argument from the state. And that, I think she would have been convicted. I don't think you needed any more than that at that point, even though that would have been dirty pool, because I do believe I don't necessarily believe that's what she meant. And she, you know, elaborated on that in her sentencing. Also, like I said, she was not a great communicator. That could be owing to the fact that she's spending 23 hours a day in by herself.
Yeah. Yeah, that has an effect on people. I mean, there's a ton of research out there on the effects of that. So if you don't believe that, check it out.
Yeah, but I suppose what she was trying to mean was, at that time, with what I was seeing and what I knew, I didn't see anything I needed to do different. What, I'm supposed to get upset because he jokes about seeing ghosts? It's a running joke. You know, how would I do anything different with this journal I didn't know anything about? It's a little bit of semantics. It was very, very poor wording in an answer if she meant something different than, mm-hmm. Nope, wouldn't do anything different.
Yeah, for sure. Now, turning to the closing arguments, I just want to kind of provide an overview of sort of what each side's close was, and then we can talk about that a little bit before we jump into the verdict.
Well, that's easy. State side was, she's a horrible mother. She ignored everything that was wrong with her 15-year-old kid. He was having serious mental issues. He had lost his friend. He'd lost his grandmother. I think he lost his dog. He was crying out for help in all these ways. Look at all these text messages. But she was too busy playing with her horses all day, working her job, and going with her boy toy to do anything about it. She even went so far as to be involved in this gun purchase, even though she was at home upset because they were supposed to go Christmas tree shopping when her husband was taking him out and buying this gun. But you endorsed that gun purchase even by your Facebook post. So you could have stopped this 97 different ways and you didn't give a crap. You should have known that this could have ended this way, but you chose not to care what your kid was doing.
And the one thing I would say that they kind of kept a consistent theme throughout the trial and came back to it in the closing was that if she had taken small, easy steps, right? And they're thinking about this. If parents are on the jury or people who have kids are responsible for somebody else, part of that calculus is, well, you know, that could be me. And, you know, what if my kid got into this and what? So if they say like, hey, if she'd have just done this one little thing, if she'd have just done this other little thing, this would have never happened.
Right. Had you taken him to a counselor, had you talked to the school and told them all the things that you knew about at home and compared them with what they knew about from school.
If you didn't buy him a gun, if you didn't let him have access to the gun, if you didn't, all these things.
Right. If you had spent one day a week with him instead of with your horses
or your
with the boy toy.
Right.
They were painting the picture that the solution here was not that she needed to be a super mom. She just needed to do something to pay a little bit of attention to her kid before it all went off the rails.
Right. And on the flip side, the defense, they're going to do what most defense attorneys are going to do. They're going to hammer on reasonable doubt.
She did not do what most defense attorneys do.
Well, okay, I'll let you talk on that in a second.
But I'm not getting too much in and out because we spent a lot of time in the video we did on YouTube breaking down that closing. It was a sight to behold, but it was anything other than what a normal, typical closing was.
What I'm saying is, when it comes to making a point that there was reasonable doubt in the case, that is something that you can expect in every closing. And she did do that. The rest of it, I agree with you. And if you want to check out what we're talking about, go over to Brothers in Crime on YouTube. We have a channel and we did a video breakdown of not the entire closing because that would have taken 35 days, but all of the what we thought were the most interesting points of the closing. But back to the theme, right? So she hammered on reasonable doubt. She talked about how the messages the prosecution relied on had different meaning than what they said. And she really underscored that the Jennifer's parenting was not the cause of this shooting. That the essentially kind of the school had messed up and they were to blame too, more than Jennifer was. That the school didn't see this shooter as a threat. That if they didn't foresee that this was going to happen, then how could his mom? And that the officials were more the school officials were more concerned about the son committing suicide than homicide. And so those are really, I think, the high-level points that she kind of made. There was a ton, to Bob's point, and you can go see it in our video, made about the parenting aspect. I think she hammered on that probably as much as anything, including offering up illustrations of her own parenting failures and misfortunes, which were just odd and weird.
Her daily life. We learned more about her daily life than we really needed to know. There was also, they brought up during the trial and the closing, the point about there had been an email between two school employees, like an administrator and a counselor, of something the shooter had done way prior to the shooting, weeks or months, days before, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But some bizarre behavior that he had exhibited, and one school person, I think it was an administrator, teacher, something, had emailed to a counselor of, hey, this was really weird. And the person that received it was like, yeah, we'll definitely keep an eye on that. And yet the parents were unaware that this issue existed or this email had ever been sent. So that was another argument from the defense of, you know, they weren't playing with full vision because the school wasn't telling them what they were seeing.
Yeah. So after all that, the jury deliberated, like I said, for a good bit of time. They spent double-digit hours, which is a considerable amount of time for a jury to spend, even in a case like this. But ultimately, on February 6, 2024, Jennifer Crumbly was convicted of all four counts of involuntary manslaughter.
Come on back for the next episode. We'll be talking about the sentencing and some other interesting things. Hey, thanks for hanging out with us on the Brothers in Crime podcast. Feedback and suggestions are always welcome. For links and resources related to this episode, please see the show notes or visit us at brothersincrimepodcast.com. We hope you'll save, subscribe, or bookmark us on your favorite podcast site and join us for the next episode.